The second thing is there are some really great innovations by leaders who are doing God's work in trying to solve the capital thing. So you mentioned Eve Picker and her work with Small Change. Patrice Frey is doing leading a really great initiative at Main Street America. Will Bradshaw out of Tulane has got some really, so I think people, and the key there is, I think we've learned after getting kicked in the teeth enough times, the institutional markets are never going to get this, and they are not going to solve this for us. The banks may, through certain vehicles, get there, but we need a new way to finance. It's not going to happen by changing the institutions that are there. They, like most sheep, they may come along when they finally see that it actually makes a difference, but we need a whole new vehicle. And I think there's some really exciting things that are happening there. They're still very nascent. It's going to take a while, but it's great to have hope that that there's going to be some solutions there. And then I think the other thing is, I'm really excited about, and again, gratified, is the intersection with this message and this approach and the industry's attention on DEI. And so while a lot of the organizations are making DEI, you know, a mission or a pillar, and they're doing this and they're doing that, we don't even talk about it, but 50% of the people in the room are BIPOC and women, because what we're doing is where those people want to work in the built environment. So we're not having to attract and, you know, run special programs. We're just talking about stuff that matters to those people. And so I'm really excited that I think we are developing a path for people, again, back to where we started, who see real estate as the means to the end, to heal their communities, to build wealth in their communities, to make a difference in their communities. And so they're doing it to shape the built environment, not just make money as a real estate developer. So those are my big three.
Welcome back to the Placemaking Podcast, your go-to source for all things community and urban development. I'm excited to introduce today's guest, Jim Hyde, the insightful author behind Building Small. With years of experience in sustainable architecture and urban design, Jim brings a fresh perspective to the table, emphasizing the significance of small-scale initiatives in creating vibrant, inclusive spaces. Join us as we delve into the fascinating world of placemaking with Jim Hyde. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Placemaking Podcast. Today, I have a very special guest I'm looking forward to talking to a lot further. I've heard him speak once or twice before in the past, and heard some of his presentations and read the books. So excited to have a chance to speak with the man, the myth, the legend himself. Mr. Jim Hyde, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Matt. Pleasure to be here. Man, the myth, the legend. I don't know about that, but anyways, I'm glad to be here. So thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, definitely. Glad you were able to make some time. We're on some different time zones, so I appreciate being able to work with me on that. Before we get too far along, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your background growing up, your interests, your passions that kind of led you into real estate, and then transition that to where you're at now and what you're working on.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. How much time do we have there to do that? I'll start with a kind of a shift in the framing, because you said, you know, real estate, how did I get started in real estate? And I like to think of my career as really being the built environment. And I make that distinction because I think there's a really big difference in definitionally between those two, whereas real estate's, you know, kind of about the buildings and assets, and built environment is about how do you create places for people to thrive. And I know this is a placemaking podcast. So with that as a launch point, it's like, okay, so what's my career path, or how did I get to focus on the built environment, and, you know, how did I land there? And, you know, in this day and age, probably not a remarkable story, but, you know, grew up in the East Coast in Pittsburgh. And the one takeaway from there was the love of old industrial buildings and going downtown, and you know, some great architecture in Pittsburgh. And, you know, as a 10-year-old, I didn't know what I was looking at. I just knew how it made me feel. And then, you know, fast forward, go to school, got involved in landscape architecture because I saw it as a path to really be shaping communities and places as opposed to buildings. Plus, I couldn't do the math, so I couldn't be an architect. And then, you know, had a career in a number of design firms, but found that a lot of the stuff I was designing just wasn't being built. And so I think that's where, if you want to use the term real estate, my passion and interest in shaping the built environment I was finding was very difficult to achieve as a designer, that I really wanted to be the client who was actually calling the shots in what was physically being built. And so that led me to go back and get a graduate degree in real estate development, and a couple of, you know, twists and turns in the career that then got me ultimately to, you know, what I'm working on now. And we can talk more about the small scale development, but that was kind of an aha moment, probably mid-career, about what scale I wanted to work at, and what I saw as both an opportunity and a meaningful way to have impact in the built environment. So,
hey, you said you grew up in Pittsburgh. You did mention the architecture. I guess how did that shape kind of your mindset in your development? Because you work on developments yourself. Is any of that from your time in Pittsburgh? Do you notice any of that that influence, I guess?
Yeah, no, definitely. And again, I think it's one of those things that I can't say I was, you know, a brilliant student at architecture growing up, but there were just things that, you know, how it made me feel. And it was, and I think about the various, you know, vignettes in my memory of places. So Pittsburgh, driving along the river and seeing the, you know, the big industrial buildings, the steel sash windows, the bricks, and then moving to Albany and, you know, going through Troy and Schenectady and the same thing. And just always having this fascination with the minimalist, the raw workmanlike character of the old industrial buildings. And then when I moved to New Orleans, worked in a firm where we were taking a lot of those buildings and creating lofts. And I just, you know, was so in love with that idea. So what I'm, you know, where I am now, I'm in one of my recent projects, which is a co-working space, very much has this kind of what we call industrial chic feel, but there's just, I've always gravitated towards that sense of, you know, industry meets humanity kind of expression in architecture. I'm not a, you know, lots of cove molding and big baseboards. I like the kind of the raw, the steel, the repurpose, the adaptive reuse. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it was the town that I grew up in, which was a kind of a suburb, you know, older suburban neighborhood outside of the steel districts of, you know, outside of Pittsburgh. And I, again, growing up, I didn't realize it, but now I go back and I look at the plan and I go back to visit. And it's like, oh my God, this is like new urbanism before it was new urbanism. I mean, my dad worked at the plant, you know, which was literally like four blocks away. The main street terminated right on the central part of the building. It was kind of the visual terminus, if you will. There were alleys, there were streets, there were little parkways. I remember as a kid going up and down the sidewalks and collecting buckeyes and then trying to sell them. You know, there's just all these things that, you know, we talk about now as new urbanists and planners of what makes a great community. And it was all right there. And so it was probably heavily ingrained in me from, you know, imprinted in me from the beginning. I just didn't know what it was, but it has had an influence. And I remember working probably, you know, 10 years into my design career on some large planned communities. And we were following the typical merchant builder model, the typical street standards. I'm like, well, why can't we put some grass between the curb and the sidewalk? And why do the homes have to like back up to the park? Why can't we turn them around and have them face the park? Wouldn't that be cool? And, you know, this was kind of about the same time that new urbanism was just bubbling up. And I didn't realize I was, you know, I think channeling the things that I enjoyed the most from my childhood but had not yet been codified and advanced by the new urbanist. So, I mean, the developers and the builders were sitting in the room like, what are you talking about? You'd never face the park because, I mean, you know what happens in parks and people don't want to have their porches looking onto the park. And, you know, now I go to great places. I was just up in a really great project in Bend, Oregon called Northwest Crossing. And they have this big central park where all of the porches face the park. And it's brilliant. And they've mixed the product types and everything else. So it's like maybe some ways I was ahead of my time, unfortunately, and why I got into development. I wasn't able to get the outcome that I was envisioning because that's just not the way it's done. You know, that's what the industry said. That's not the way it's done. So I was hoping I could get to a place where I could say, yeah, it's how I can do it and see how well it works. So,
yeah. Yeah, we'll dive into that deeper. I know we will as part of this discussion because, you know, the whole idea, you know, behind the book and behind the groups and everything is how do we utilize the existing fabric, but, you know, potentially bend the rules to some degree to create great spaces, and they don't have to be big spaces, right?
Right.
So, right. You know, small change. Speaking of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So I think we'll dive that into that a little deeper here in a little bit, but just curious, kind of transitioning into going back for your master's, you know, what prompted that decision? Did you feel like that was necessary for you to make that next step into, I assume so, but I guess what kind of factors went into that decision, and do you feel like that was a good decision for you at the time, and how did that benefit you moving forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. There was a lot of soul searching that went into it. You know, it's interesting because my daughter's now out of college and she's been out for a couple of years, and she started talking about a master's, and you know, and I'm thinking about the, you know, the I guess the path that I went through. And so my big dilemma was, I mean, I think like a lot of people that want to go back and get a graduate degree, it's like I've either plateaued in my career or I don't feel like I have the tools I need to get to where I want to go. And so I, you know, was going through that kind of introspection. But my dilemma was, or my choice was, do I go back and get an advanced design degree because I want to, you know, hone my skills and my, you know, thought process as a designer? Or do I go back and balance my design in my left brain with my right brain or vice versa and go back and get a business degree? So there was a lot of time spent, you know, MBA or master's of urban design or something like that. And I think after, you know, probably about 10 years, and I, you know, I did, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, I think I want to learn real estate development. So A, I can either be a better communicator about good design and convince my clients what they should be building, or I just want to go work for a developer because then I'm my own client. Wouldn't that be great? I don't have to have somebody tell me what to do. We can talk about how I've learned that isn't the case. You always have a client. You always have a client, right? No matter where you land in the food chain. It's just how far down the rung you are. But so I went back and decided that development was what I wanted to learn and potentially do. And I did it pretty late. You know, I'd been working probably for about 15 years when I did that. It was interesting. One of my colleagues, it was a firm called Design Workshop. One of the key figures there, Kurt Culbertson, who was kind of, you know, we talk a lot about this. He's like, you know, if you want to be a developer, you don't need to, you know, everything you need to know to be a developer. Being a development is just having the cojones to go out and get money. and I thought, well, that's pretty crass. But I've kind of learned that, you know, really it is that the gateway in a lot of ways to people who can do a lot is their chutzpah to go out and get money and how they put that together. And as we can talk about from building small, it clearly is the biggest challenge to scaling this as a typology for development is access to capital. But anyway, so it was a great experience. I often say it was like learning a foreign language because the design schools do a lousy job of talking about the realities of how business works and how 90% of the world makes their decisions, and you may not like it, and I get frustrated by it, but I at least now understand that IRR is a currency that people use to make decisions. Net present value is a critical piece of the calculus. And I mean, I remember the first couple of weeks when they were teaching this stuff, and I'm just like so far over my skis, like, what is this? And why is that? You know, when are we going to talk about placemaking? You know, so it's, you know, it's really important. And I think if I could, and that's why when I go to design schools and talk, I really do try and communicate that. It's like, you know, if you're a designer, you really ought to take an accounting class. Like, why would I do that? You know, I can't fit everything in. It's like, you just got to understand how a balance sheet works. Cause if you don't, you just, you know, you're not going to be as influential as you should be. And you won't be valued as much as the contribution you're making in the conversations. So,
oh, that's great. That's something I talk with our design teams, but also, you know, I think there's several on this call that are in that boat or are designers or are interested in development that are in the design field. And, you know, just taking small steps even at this point would be valuable even if you decided not to go into development or real estate offshoot. I mean, yeah. I think just having that understanding of where the money comes from, right? The easy stuff, but ultimately it's kind of hard to visualize if you're focused on the design and ultimately it could potentially help you out, you know, in your design to understand the factors at play. So that's all great. We've talked about iconic places, you know, New Orleans, Pittsburgh, Albany. All these places have.
Well, I wouldn't put Albany in the iconic category, but the other two.
Well, yeah. Maybe not for architecture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll stick with Pittsburgh and New Orleans. Then. they have a unique style, unique architecture, very different locations, very different climate, very different personalities, different cultures. And you've traveled many other places, but has there been a place that you visited or lived in that has really transformed your view of the built environment?
Yeah, I mean, it clearly was New Orleans, you know, and I think the path that I had was, you know, grew up in Albany, went to school in Idaho, which is a whole nother story, moved from there to Vermont, to New Orleans, Denver, Phoenix, grad school in Boston, then finally San Francisco. So if you drew a line between New Orleans, San Francisco, and Boston, there's a lot of similarities between architecture and grain and richness of neighborhoods. But New Orleans, because it was early in my career, I had just kind of, you know, barely gotten into the design profession. I was working for a firm that was just loaded with talented people, and it was a fun time to be there. So it was one of those really defining places that I learned so much, not in a educational way, but in an immersive kind of experiential way. And so it was, you know, walking the neighborhoods, the quirky street layout that emanates from, you know, intersecting with the river, the incredible array of housing types that are all on the same block, the richness of detailing, the way that the neighborhoods functioned, the corner stores still existed within neighborhoods, you know, and you knew the people in there. So without it being a, you know, a dissertation on place, it was an experiential just living, you know, a great place. And so many of the things that I then carried forward as I would work on projects were, you know, memories and vignettes and experiences I had there that then would try and instill. And again, I remember, you know, back to that project, the Big Plan Community Project, I was thinking about all the quirky street intersections that happen in New Orleans that make that, you know, kind of serendipitous, memorable place where then you get funky buildings and everything else. And so we're working on this large project, 25,000 acres in the desert. And I'm drawing these streets that don't align. And it's like a five-way intersection. And the principal comes in like, what the hell are you doing? You can't do that. I'm like, well, but that's the way it is in New Orleans. Yeah, but we're not building. I mean, it was just so funny that I, you know, that, and now, of course, a lot of the new urbanism is striving and solving for a lot of that kind of quirkiness and those, you know, those alignments and those serendipitous moments. But again, it was one of those things where the translation from what I had experienced and was so magical and memorable and so rich. And then you try to translate that to a new project under the rules that Public Works gives you or Capital Markets gives you or Merchant Builders give you. There was just like, there was no relationship at all. So,
yeah. Yeah, those rules. Mm-hmm. Those pesky rules.
Pesky rules.
And I'm sure we'll be discussing those as they come up in challenges and projects and whatnot. But you literally wrote a book called Building Small. I've got it right here. I just yep. want to, you know, bring it here and be able to reference it if it came up. But your ideal development project to work on, and how has that project type changed over the years for you as a developer, assuming that piece, not a designer, but as a true developer, how's that changed?
Yeah, but it's a great question. So many of these questions really force you to look back and think about things. And I think about when I was in school and when I graduated from college, I've always been pretty good at like future casting where I saw myself in 20 years and then trying to back cast, okay, how do I get there? And it was just, you know, it's either a blessing or a curse because you never feel like you got there, but at least I had a vision of what I wanted to accomplish. And there was always this notion that I wanted to live in a town where I could really play a role in shaping kind of the downtown core. And so the ideal project that I, you know, it would be this mixed use infill building that's well detailed at the ground floor, has some residential, has a great, you know, storefront activity. And I'd live in the super cool loft, you know, up above. And so I'm not sure that I don't think that the project type and kind of vision has changed at all. And I think about places I lived, you know, I lived in a loft in San Francisco for 20 years. I now live in a small town very close to Main Street and have done a couple projects that are at least close to that. So some visioning with intentionality, you know, you ultimately get there. But I think what has changed about it now, knowing the calculus of development, and it's, I don't know that it's changed the project, it's probably just increased the frustration. So that, you know, that vision of the, you know, cool little downstairs retail with the residential, but well, you got mixed product types, so who wants to finance that? And yeah. How do you get that cool loft, you know, within the existing zoning? And what are you going to do about parking? And so it's all back to those rules. It's all the rules and kind of gravity that makes those, you know, very, very difficult to achieve. And then there's just the practicality. Okay, how do you get site control? And it's probably something that, you know, a lot of the students and people I meet in a lot of these emerging developer programs, it's like, how do I even tie up the land? I don't have any money. So there's that whole thing. So the real process of when you don't have, when you got a clear vision, got a lot of passion, you have one of the skill sets, you're either a broker or an architect or a builder or contractor, but you're trying to find the money. It's, you know, it's really, really challenging. And so I would say the vision, you know, as I was thinking about this question this morning, the vision probably hasn't changed in 20 or 30 years, but where you start and the practicality of how you can actually implement it, you know, has changed a lot. So
where'd that vision come from, by the way? I'm just curious. You said that was in your undergrad. You were starting to think about that, or was that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah. I was wrapping up my bachelor's degree and I was living in Northern Idaho and we kind of traveled through the Northwest. And I said, I'm going to live in Seattle or Portland. I was just bound and determined. And of course this was, you know, I'll give away my age, 1980. So it was, you know, major recession. Nobody was hiring anywhere. But there was, I think, a combination of tours and things I'd studied. And again, this hangover from the architecture of Pittsburgh and Troy and Schenectady, that kind of industrial, that love of kind of that industrial building typology, just created this image in my mind of what, you know, what I was going to be doing, what I was going to focus on. And again, it wasn't until I moved to San Francisco that I actually bought an old warehouse somebody else was the developer, but it was great. And it was like, you know, wow, I'd really arrived at, you know, what I had kind of envisioned, what would that have been like 20 years later. So it was super cool. And it was everything that I hoped it would be. So it was actually really a great, you know, kind of outcome. So
what drove the passion for that type of, do you think it's the community? Do you think it's the walkability? I guess, what about that drew you to that vision? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And again, I think this is one of those things that, you know, I've been doing a series of these podcasts, and you're all asking me these really tough questions, but it's been super fun to reflect on, again, those moments in your life and the things that you remember that shape, you know, your passion and your interest in ways that you don't know are happening at the moment. So what I would say is, I told the story of Pittsburgh. We lived in kind of an old urbanist neighborhood. We moved to Albany, actually not Albany. We moved to the outskirts of Albany in what I call the milquetoast suburbs. And, you know, it was classic suburbia, and it was on a cul-de-sac, boring as hell. Walked to school, no real sense of place or form or legibility in the layout. And I just felt, I don't know, uninspired. And then I started working in the summers in Albany for a guy who was actually a slumlord, but he had a whole portfolio of these incredible brownstones, which he wasn't taking very good care of, but the soul and the character and the form of these buildings all lined up with these, you know, stone steps and everything was just magnificent. And I'd love going down there to work. I mean, it was horrible work, but it was just amazing to walk the streets and see these buildings. So there was something about that definitely caught my attention. And then I think the experiences in New Orleans and from there. So I think the intersection of that typology is a combination of the material expression and that idea again of that workmanlike building and making it your home. So it's a little bit edgy, but I think the other thing you mentioned, and I found in my projects, there is a through line of using development to create community. And so whether it's the co-working space that I did, the magic of that is the community that's built here, and the cottage court that I did, the magic is really, it's the architecture is great. You know, the physical form, the urban design is great, but the magic for me is how the people that have moved in there, that none of them knew each other, have formed a pretty tight knit group pretty quickly because of the way that you can design to facilitate the creation of community. So there's that combination of expression and materiality around kind of, again, that industrial ethic, a little more simpler, a little more raw, and then the goal to use the built environment to create community and connect people in, you know, chance ways and formal ways.
Yeah. It's always interesting to hear, you know, the influence and what really drives some of the decisions that people make and their visions and how those came about. Kind of fast forward that to, you know, your first development project. Is the co-working space correct? Is that your first true development?
Well, for better. So, I mean, like a lot of small developers, my first project, yeah, you could say was, you know, renovation. It was the first place that I bought, and it was a renovation. So you kind of get your hands dirty and you learn about the permit process and you figure out how to cobble together all the interest-free credit cards for a while to pay for things until you can refinance out and pay off the credit cards. And hopefully you haven't gotten too far over your skis, and you learn that you can do that. And more importantly, you learn that you can sleep at night with a big, you know, big bill sitting out there that you might not be able to pay. And then you trade it up to the next one. So I had done probably 3 or 4 of those and had actually lived in them. They weren't fix and flips. They were ones that we were living in. Okay. And then a colleague of mine, kind of a family friend who our kids had gone to preschool together, liked what I had done in terms of these houses that we're in. One of them we kept for rental, the other one we lived in, and liked real estate, liked design, wanted to maybe invest in some things or do some things together. So that really led to the first real ground up project, which was River House, the cottage court. But insanely, I decided not just to do that and see it all the way through. I decided that we should also do a co-working space at the same time. And I decided I should write a book about the whole process and all that I was learning at the same time. So I went very quickly from, you know, kind of weekends working on renovations that we would live in to two ground up projects and a book all running concurrently. And that was very steep learning curve. Very happy with the outcome on both of them. Probably not something I will ever do again, at least in terms of a sequence, you know, as a small developer, sole entrepreneur, definitely have to build a team. So, that was kind of that run.
Well, do you want to describe both those projects? And we'll dive into the book here in a little bit, but maybe give us a taste of what each one really was about, and then we can dive in a little bit more on specific things.
And it's been super fun to, I mean, it was insane in some ways to do both of those, not really having done, there are two things. I was doing ground up construction and I was doing a commercial renovation, neither of which I had done. I had been doing residential renovations, and the ones before had been, you know, you'd find some guys that, you know, were good carpenters and you'd kind of do it as owner builder. So now I was pulling legitimate permits. There were construction loans. I was financing some of it with, you know, home equity line and stuff like that. So it was getting pretty complicated. But the River House, which is the cottage court, 1.2 acres, 12 units total. So 10 units per acre. There's really 8 single family residences and 4 accessory dwelling units. So I like to tell the story. It's 8 from a revenue standpoint, it's 8 units. From a policy standpoint, it's 12 units. And there were a lot of great lessons that were learned out of that in terms of the effectiveness of design, being creative, subordinating the vehicle, great kind of broad front porches that catalyze the neighborhood, kind of a neo-traditional development. So the cars tucked in the back, range of products. Built through the pandemic. So that was really interesting and came to market right as the pandemic kind of the end. So we came to market in July of 21. I jokingly say, you know, just as I planned, you know, timed it perfectly because the market was super hot. People were trying to get out of San Francisco. They wanted a place. We live in a town called Healdsburg, which is very desirable, kind of a lifestyle community. So we sold out in 5 months and got very, very good, very favorable pricing, and learned a lot about that. One of the big lessons of that one, because I'm very proud of the project. I think people really love the design. But the challenge with that, and I hear this again and again in places I go, the smaller projects of that scale. So you imagine, so we've got basically 12 residential buildings plus 3 garage buildings. Finding a builder who will take that on, it's too big for a custom builder or the guy with the pickup truck, but it's too small for the merchant builder. So who actually builds in that space and can think like a production builder in terms of efficiency and sequencing, but do it cost effectively. So that was I was fortunate. I did have a good builder from a skill standpoint, and he had come out of a production world and was now moving more smaller scale. So he was able to grind through it. But it was challenging, and you run into all kinds of issues at that scale. Where you again, in this case, he was a very good builder, built a very good product. Had no overhead. So scheduling, budget management, all that kind of stuff was just, you know, really challenging. So the advice I would give to anybody in the space is you really got to pick your contractor carefully and make sure they've got bench depth to do that kind of stuff. Or that if that's your sweet spot, then you need to do it. But you really need to make sure somebody's doing that. The other project, which is the co-working space, is 4,500 square feet. It's an adaptive reuse of an old kind of suburban bank building or a bank space in a suburban shopping center built in the 60s, single floor. And it was a complete gut job. Place had been sitting vacant for a long time, really horrific kind of interior. So we took it down to the studs, all new electrical, cut the slab because had to move bathrooms, all that kind of stuff. So learned a lot about commercial, learned a lot about ADA, which is, you know, really onerous when you're doing this kind of stuff and expensive, you know, changing the entire door front system. I had a, when we actually cut the back of the vault out, which turned out to be one of our cooler spaces, but there was a half inch difference between the floor of the vault inside and the floor outside. So a half inch, big deal. Nope, got to get ADA access. So I had to pour this very special, very expensive concrete ramp that ran out like 8 feet into the other space. Cost me like $2,500 just for this little concrete ramp to be able to get in the door. So, you know, and then you have all the stuff with the bathrooms and that. So very, very expensive. And in California, you have a, you know, good for them because it has had a meaningful impact on our energy consumption. But the codes are very, very stringent around energy. So, you know, $120,000 in lighting upgrades and super efficient, you know, daylight sensors and all that kind of stuff. So very expensive. The one tip I would give for small scale developers on this is something a lot of people don't know is there is a tax credit for ADA improvements that you self-report and you self-claim. And it's if you, for every, well, you can get $5,000 a year and it's a tax credit, not a deduction. So you can get, you have to spend $10,250 and you get $5,000 in tax credit and it's in a given year. And I was able to sequence this where I started construction in December. So I got enough in December of 18 to claim it. I did all of the construction in 19. I was able to claim it. And then I had a little bit of hangover work that I needed to do in 20. So I was able to get it three times, but it's, you know, it's free money and it's pretty easy to spend $10,000 in ADA improvements because everything that you do from lighting to little ramps to changing door systems to bathrooms, you know, can add up pretty quickly. So that's a little funding tip for people. And the other challenge of the co-working space is then because I was not only the developer, I was also the operator. And I said, because like, how hard could it be to run a co-working space? You know, that's naivete again. So I was my tenant, I was my operator, and I was the developer and the landlord. And actually structured another little tip, structured that in two ventures. So I have an LLC that took the lease from the landlord because I don't own the building, I lease it. And then I immediately subleased it to the entity I had set up for the co-working. And the thinking was not to bet against myself, but the thinking was if the operating entity just doesn't work and it goes bankrupt, I don't want to bring all of the investment in the space down. I can kick myself out the door on Monday and be leasing it ideally to somebody else on Tuesday. So it was a, you know, development's all about managing risk. And so that was a management risk thing. The good piece of that, though, too, from a tax standpoint, is I was able to take all of those improvements, which were run through the what's called the holdco, the entity that was doing the improvements that had the master lease, and section 179 them in my taxes. So I was able to pull all of those costs forward as a write-off right away. And that was a gift that kept giving for about 3 or 4 years because you could carry those forward. So it really helped from a tax income standpoint for quite a few years. And again, so thinking through those structures early on are really, really important. And as a small developer, you don't think it's like, well, I'll get the space and I'll figure it out. Be really smart about how you structure and paper things from the beginning is because it'll set you up to really be successful later on should things go south.
We'll get into lessons learned here in a little bit. But
yeah. Sorry, I kind of jumped ahead there, but it's all connected for me.
No, I think that's great. I think I'm curious. Did you have that plan from the start? Is this something you knew about and learned about previously? Or was this something that you found out during the process that maybe this makes sense to do it this way? And who'd you learn this from? And I mean, there's so many questions.
A lot of it, a lot of it was just a combination of luck and instinct. Did not learn. It was just, I think, again, I made the comment that, you know, development is really about managing risk. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about what could go wrong. How do I prepare myself for something to go wrong? And then how do you protect yourself accordingly? So, and, you know, any good developer knows that, and you kind of learn those things along the way. So a lot of it, I think, was luck combined with just gut intuition. And I think you just have to learn. I mean, I will say through both of those things, a lot of things that I was constantly questioning myself about, it's like, no, that really was a pretty good instinct. I mean, we're, one of the things I'll tell you about the co-working space was I had a lot of people trying to rent me space that was like second floor and it was cheaper and all that kind of stuff. But I had this, just this gut feeling that co-working is a retail use. It's not an office use. And people want to be kind of looking through the window out to the street, seeing people go by, see and be seen and all that kind of stuff. And for whatever reason, that was always just a basic premise. And it was, at least in this location where it was dead on. I think if we had been upstairs, it just would not have worked. But it is this kind of, you know, work meets theater, work meets club kind of feel, and having it on the ground floor, got a really lovely kind of lounge area with a big fireplace that you see from the street. And it really makes, it's just about the experience and building community. And I don't think you do that by having to go up a flight of stairs into, you know, a second floor office that has drop-in tile ceilings and all that kind of stuff. So there is a lot of it was instinctive, and I encourage people, if you've got sensibility, you got to kind of go with your gut. The other thing is, I think just talking to people there, because there are no rule books. I think a lot of people, small developers, don't feel like they know enough. So it's like, well, just give me the checklist. What do I got to do? And it's like, well, there really isn't a checklist. You got to do a little soul searching. You got to do a lot of observation, figure out what really excites you when you go places, talk to the people that made those places, and start to connect the dots. And that's what it's all about.
In transitioning here to, you know, the two developments you talked about, but more broadly, what attributes of those two developments make them the most special? And then generally, just in the placemaking, the actual building of place, what attributes in your mind or stand out the most, I guess, or bring the most excitement to a certain place or a draw to the place? What are those attributes?
Yeah, for me, I think there's probably three things. And the first one is, and it goes back to, I think, where we started the conversation. If you think about built environment versus real estate, it's how do we use physical form, both the buildings and the spaces in between, to create, you know, human connections. How do you create something where people are, you know, they want to just hang out, they want to linger, they want to engage with the space in some way. And, you know, they just feel really comfortable. They just, you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, if you walk into a store or a bar where it just feels really good to just hang out, I love this place, I want to have a drink, you know. And to me, that's a big part of placemaking. And it is a lot of, there are no rules. There's just kind of thinking through that. And I think the people that do it well just intuitively know it. The other thing I'm a really big proponent of, and I think that we talked earlier in the session about rules, I think the preponderance on rules, because people don't know what they're looking at, so they default to, you know, so whether it's design guidelines or it's standards, because they can't interpret what could be, they just want to administer what they've been told. We really have stripped out so much what I call nano inspirations from designs. And I loved it. I mean, I came up with that term when I went to visit the High Line, and it was like, I was walking along the High Line and I'd have this moment, and you'd look at something, it's like, man, it's it's an emotional connection. And it was this combination of industry and wild native, you know, grasses that had been carefully selected and everything. And it was just like, it was set against the backdrop of, you know, the New York City skyline. So I think places that inspire people They may not know that they're being inspired, but they just feel good. You know, they're excited about it. So I think that's a really big part of placemaking. And then the last one is I'm a really big proponent in my design of timeless design. I think there's so much in the industry that's about chasing the latest fad and what was on the latest cover of the magazine, and just really good design, which ultimately relies on detailing and material choices and things that, you know, the background role versus the inspirational role, and really understanding that hierarchy. And I think there is a trend where that's heavily historicist, where we need to build everything like we used to build it, which I'm not a big fan of. But then there's also a trend that's like ultra contemporary. Look at me, forget everything else around, you know, my building, because it's all about my building. And I really admire and love the people who can walk the line between those two, respect the context, embrace history and what good design, historical design has taught us about proportion and scale, but can bring it up to a materiality and, you know, a character that matches kind of where we are at this point in, you know, the human kind of evolution. So I think timelessness, you know, the ability to create inspiration, and then the ability to forge human connection, to me are, you know, the three key ingredients.
Yeah. I think, and touch on your last point here, but necessarily have to be traditional architecture, because a lot of times the more contemporary architecture entangled with the traditional in some backgrounds just lends to the character of this, the community, and kind of gives you a kind of perspective of the change of the community over time. And
right.
I think that lends to the place as well. So, and you touched on that. I just, in my, you know, just experience of places, those quirky buildings that stand out are always kind of lend to the other buildings as well, and they draw right. off each other. It's it creates a great space, and you've got several good examples here in the book on that.
Yeah, the cover.
So I want to transition there. Like that transition into your book, Building Small, and how that came about. And then, you know, let's talk through some of the roadblocks, the hurdles. We've already mentioned one. You were trying to do two separate projects at the same time.
Yeah, right.
On top
right,
of this
right,
project. Right. Tell us about the genesis of this book and how it came about.
Yeah, well, for better or for worse, I mean, part of that, you know, forward vision, I guess I'd always wanted to write a book. I don't know why. The more I talk to people, a lot of people, I think, hold that aspiration for some reason. The challenge I'd always had was like, definitely suffer from ADD. So it's like, what am I passionate enough about that I will actually see this all the way through to the end? And in 2012, when I started this small scale developer forum, which is this gathering twice a year of small developers from all over the country, and we go to a different city. So over the course of about the first seven or eight of those, we would go to these cities, we'd see these projects, that many of them that have the qualities of things that I had just mentioned. But more importantly, we would hear from the developers, and we would hear a couple of things. We'd hear how passionate they were. We would hear the kinds of impacts they were creating. And we would hear how incredibly difficult these projects were, how long they had been at it, how difficult it was to clear the regulatory hurdles, how many different ways they had to approach the capital and that kind of stuff. And so after about, I think it was the seventh or eighth one, I was literally flying home on the plane. And I'm like, this is just an incredible story. There's so much impact. And there's so many people in the space, but because it's so fragmented, because it's really one and two person shops working hyper locally, they don't have any time to, you know, they're not writing press releases and whatever else. Nobody's telling this story. And I thought, you know, I think this is something, this could be the thing that would allow me to write a book. I'm pretty passionate about it. I've really gotten deeply involved in the forum as a platform for things that I believed. And so I embarked on the book. Raise some money to hire an intern to help me with some research. And then the point about, I was doing this with, I was doing the other two projects, but the upside of that, and I often say that if I had finished the book on time, it would have been a very different book. So I was about 2 years later from when I was supposed to deliver the manuscript to Urbanland Institute. But in those 2 years, I was doing these projects. So those that have read it and the feedback I've gotten is the accessibility, the practical lessons, the really deeply personal journey that's explained, that really, I think, resonates with people that either want to be there or in that space, grew out of the fact that I was, I was living the dream every day. I was writing about the thesis of why small matters and what it is and what's important. And then the how-to toolkit, I was, having those nights when I couldn't sleep because it's like, am I really going to be able to pay off this construction loan? Or what did I do? What does a section of the LLC agreement really mean? Oh my God, I'm really glad I got this in here because it's really important. Or what are the regulatory hurdles and how do you get the neighbors on board and all that kind of stuff? So there is a lot of, I think, as I often talk about the book, there's a lot of practical information that is not real estate 101, but it's how do you develop small and what is different about that and the nuances, what is different about that than what you would learn in an MRED program or attending a professional development seminar on real estate. So.
Yeah, that's great. It's great. I love that you provided plenty of examples throughout the book too. That I think that was for me the most valuable, one of the most valuable pieces was seeing things. I mean, it just stoked my imagination of what could be done, in this area. As someone in the design field, I deal with the authorities having jurisdiction and what jurisdiction they do have and how that impacts not only, local developers looking at small scale projects, but, the larger ones as well. So, but this provided some other tools in the toolkit, right, to have those discussions. So I think that was great. I appreciate it. I know how much time it took you for this book. So, I appreciate that you spent that time and I hope others have gained that same value. I'm sure they have. So that's not a small feat.
Yeah, no small feat for a building small book. But right. Well, I will say I'm really happy with the way it came out. And especially, I had this, had a great designer, John Hall, that I got to work with on it. And, my opening remark to him was, I don't want this to be your father's real estate textbook. I want this to be almost magazine quality where people could pick it up and open to any page and just kind of dive in. It's not something you read from end to end that you refer to. And that's one of the many gratifying things, feedback I get is, I love the way it's laid out. I love all, as you said, all the examples and the imagery, and I can just fan through it. And I look at it all the time and I use it as a resource. And that it's just, it's a really accessible read as opposed to the highly dense technical tomes that, I think the industry puts out, which
that would have scared anybody from wanting to get into it. I mean, exactly. I think this makes it more accessible, not only to read the book, but also to think of someone being in that position to say, okay, well, I don't necessarily have to know everything there is about real estate to make that first step, at least,
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of that first step, what do you think is the most, I would say, largest hurdle or most commonly utilized hurdle for new developers looking into just say building small at the grassroots level? And what advice, other than reading the book, would you give to those looking to get into real estate development at this small scale?
Yeah. Well, we've talked about, the hurdle is truly capital. It's regulations and capital. And I do feel like the regulatory environment is changing, whether it's being mandated from a high or people in the local communities are actually getting it. There's still a lot of other challenges there, but I think capital now is the 800 pound gorilla and regulation, maybe the 600 pound gorilla. But I think if you want to get into this, and I think a lot of people do, because at the end of the day, as my friend Alan Razak says, people are in this because you want to build something. You know, we're not people that just want to sit around and do drawings and have them sit on the shelf or hang on the wall. Anybody that is really doing this wants to build something. So you've got to figure out why you want to build it, what it is you want to build, and then how you're going to get there. There is a series of questions in the book that I ask. And again, this grew out of my personal journey. I think you really have to ask yourself the tough questions. Do I have the intestinal fortitude to go through this? Because there's a lot of people that I think are linear thinkers. They're very task oriented. And it's like, well, I did that. I made that decision. I'm moving on. Versus this is a very ambiguous process. It's very iterative. It can be very circular. And you may revisit decisions 3 or 4 times. And you got to be able to live with that. So there's these kind of, you know, personal skill sets that you need to either be self-aware about or train yourself to be ready for. So that's kind of setting the table. And then I think getting in, you know, I would say start small, very small. If you've never done any of this, you know, finally, like I said, I started off doing a couple of just renovations, and you learn a lot about that, about the way the trades work and contracts and permits and all that kind of stuff, so that you can build on that. To jump in and think you're going to build a 20,000 square foot, you know, mixed use building that's going to be net zero and well standard and all that kind of stuff, and you've never done anything like that, it's like, well, you might want to rethink about that. So the other thing is, I think finding a good partner. We talk a lot about that, you know, because a lot of people are like, well, I had my idea and I got this tied up, you know, I want it all. And it's like, well, you know, getting 50% of a deal that gets built is a lot better than 100% of a deal that never gets out of the ground. So finding a good partner you can learn from, maybe somebody who's really seasoned that will take you under their wing. We have a lot of people in the small scale forum that I think have found, you know, somebody who was once an entrepreneur or has done really well. They're kind of in the last chapter of their career and they just want to pay it forward and see an entrepreneur succeed the way they got a chance to, and maybe live vicariously off of the ride that person is creating. You know, they've kind of made their money, they've taken the risks, but to see a young person, man or woman, you know, fighting the battles and learning from it and everything is kind of fun for them, and they can give some advice and they can be there to back you up. So I think finding good partners early on is really important. The other thing that I learned from, and it was an aha moment that I had when we had our forum. It was our 18th forum and we were in Nashville. And this is a bit of a generalization, but there are generally two kinds of markets in the US. There are high barrier to entry markets and there are low barrier to entry markets. So the high barrier entry is typically coastal or some of the, you know, she communities like Aspen or Breckenridge or, you know, some of the resort communities. And so what that means is it's very difficult as a developer to break in there. But if you are somebody who has permitting skills, who has design chops and knows the process to get something entitled, the market is always there. You can always create value. And the path as a small developer is probably through creative designing, hacks in the codes, getting stuff designed and built. But if you're in a low barrier to entry market, which might be an area like, you know, a Phoenix or a Nashville, where there's still regulations, but there's a lot of land and they're happy to approve stuff, Atlanta might be one. The path for a lot of small developers we saw there was through brokerage, because they were on the front end of the leading trends and they knew which neighborhoods were going to be hot in 5 years and they could read the tea leaves. They knew how to negotiate acquisition. They knew how to structure partnerships. So they were getting in early, tying up assets and then executing the projects and creating a lot of value later on. So I think assessing where you are and what your skill set is as your starting point is really, really important. And again, that was an aha moment that I just had a year or two ago, and I've really seen it kind of play out more and more depending on where I am. So,
yeah, all good advice. I think the partnership and starting small for me resonate, because that's something I hear a decent amount, but at the same time, it's the hardest for most people to actually implement. Call it shameless pride, or there's a feeling that, you know, I can do it on my own, but it really does. It really helps when you have a partner that can see those roadblocks or pitfalls, I guess, in the way, and then, you know, hopefully could help in providing some value in other ways as well. So, like you said, 50% of a deal that gets done is better than 100% that doesn't get done. So, that's all great. I'll finish up here with one last question, and it's more of a forward-looking question. What excites you most about real estate development or building small currently, and what trends are you looking at?
Well, it's around building small, and I think what I am increasingly excited about, or maybe looking forward to, is, you know, so building small will be 3 years old next month. It came out in April of 21. And I think the response that it's gotten has been, you know, it's been really, I don't know, fulfilling, gratifying. But what's interesting is when I go to places and I do a book talk, and a lot of times there are industry things, and I'll go to a big city and it'll be a bunch of the big REITs or the big architecture firms, and I'm kind of, you know, a little nervous going in there, and I'm like, oh, they're going to say, well, that's a quaint idea, Sonny, but that's, you know, that's not how places really get built, and that's not the reality of the world. And I will say, almost to a T, everywhere I've been, people are like, absolutely, we have forgotten how to do this, and this is how communities were built, and we got to solve this. We got to figure this out. So that's one thing. I think there's a increasing recognition that we've lost the art of this, and we need to figure it out. The second thing is there are some really great innovations by leaders who are doing God's work in trying to solve the capital thing. So you mentioned Eve Picker and her work with Small Change. Patrice Frey is leading a really great initiative at Main Street America. Will Bradshaw out of Tulane has got some really, so I think people, and the key there is, I think we've learned after getting kicked in the teeth enough times, the institutional markets are never going to get this, and they are not going to solve this for us. The banks may, through certain vehicles, get there, but we need a new way to finance. It's not going to happen by changing the institutions that are there. They, like most sheep, they may come along when they finally see that it actually makes a difference, but we need a whole new vehicle. And I think there's some really exciting things that are happening there. They're still very nascent. It's going to take a while, but it's great to have hope that there's going to be some solutions there. And then I think the other thing is, I'm really excited about, and again, gratified, is the intersection with this message and this approach and the industry's attention on DEI. And so while a lot of the organizations are making DEI, you know, a mission or a pillar, and they're doing this and they're doing that, we don't even talk about it, but 50% of the people in the room are BIPOC and women, because what we're doing is where those people want to work in the built environment. So we're not having to attract and, you know, run special programs. We're just talking about stuff that matters to those people. And so I'm really excited that I think we are developing a path for people, again, back to where we started, who see real estate as the means to the end, to heal their communities, to build wealth in their communities, to make a difference in their communities. And so they're doing it to shape the built environment, not just make money as a real estate developer. So those are my big three.
Love it, Jim. I really, really do appreciate all your time today and talking through this. Love the book. For those that may not know about the book or know your mission yet, you want to give a little shout out to where people can find out more about you and the book and your mission, and we'll close it.
Sure. Oh, so just three quick PSAs. So the first one is we're standing up an online network for small developers. It's buildingsmall.com. MN, like MaryNancy.co. And this is a social community. It's like a private LinkedIn for small-scale developers, chat, resources, programs and stuff like that. So that's the first thing. Join, it's free. A lot of great content there. The second thing is the Small Scale Developer Forum, which I think I mentioned, the genesis of the book and all that, twice a year. The next one is in Bend, Oregon, May 13th through 15th. And then the next one after that, number 22, will be in Kansas City in October, dates to be determined. And then I'm hoping to come your way, Matt, in 25. Yeah. I'm hoping to come to Fayetteville. So much great stuff there. I'm really excited about coming there in the fall. So I've been talking to some of your colleagues there and local developers doing cool stuff. So there's that. And then the last thing is you can get to the book. You can get to the buildingsmallmn.co. You can get more on the small scale forums on my website, which is jheid.com. And that'll drive you to all of these as well. So three great places to kind of check things out. And lots of great resources, great people at the forums. Typically, next one in Bend, I think we'll probably have about 65 people. We always see great projects, great networking, a lot of inspiration. So if you're in that region and you want to see what this is all about, it's going to be a really great program. So looking forward to that.
That's awesome. I'll have to make the next one. I mean, Kansas City is not too far for me. I can certainly make that one.
Okay.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for all your time, Jim. I really appreciate you discussing building small, and look forward to future conversations.
Yeah, Matt, thanks so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure meeting you when I was back there in January, and I appreciate you spreading the good word here. And people want to reach out to me. It's jim@jheid.com. So pretty easy. And always available, and just want to make this make small big. So we'll do it.
Awesome. Appreciate it.
Okay. All right, Matt. See you later. Thanks.